Hey everyone, welcome back to the Deep Dive. We're always digging into these really meaty topics, and today is no exception. We're going to be tackling something pretty fascinating and honestly, surprisingly relevant even today from the Apostle Paul.
Okay, I'm intrigued. Hit me with it.
So we're going to be looking at his first letter to the Corinthians, specifically chapters 8 through 11. And we're using some great material here from Dr. Gary Metter's lecture 23 on 1 Corinthians. It's all centered around this well, you could call it a dilemma, I guess, about food that had been offered to idols.
Yeah, I can see how that would be a tricky situation for those early Christians.
Oh, absolutely. And, it wasn't just some theoretical, theological debate for them either.
Yeah.
Think about it.
Sure.
You're living in a bustling Roman colony like Corinth, a real melting pot of cultures and religions, temples everywhere you look, and a good chunk of the social scene, even some of the food you'd encounter, had ties to these pagan rituals.
Yeah, I see what you mean. It's a whole different context than what we're used to today.
Right. It makes you really appreciate how these early believers had to navigate their faith in a world that wasn't exactly, shall we say, faith-friendly.
Mm-hmm.
Especially if you were a new convert, maybe coming from a Jewish background, where the idea of one God was, like, the bedrock of your understanding. Trying to figure out how to live in that society without compromising your newfound beliefs. Man, that must have been a real tightrope walk.
No kidding. You're right. It really makes you think about how they balance things.
And then you throw in things like social status and these emerging ideas about individual rights, and it gets even more complicated.
So where are we headed with all of this? What's the big question we're grappling with today?
Well, the core of this deep dive, the thing we're going to keep circling back to, is this. How did Paul guide the Corinthian church through all of this? How did he help them hold on to that firm belief in one true God, while also stressing the vital importance of community and being sensitive to those who, well, maybe hadn't quite grasped the full picture yet?
Yeah, I'm listening. So what did Paul have to say about all of this?
All right, let's jump into chapter 8, where Paul tackles this tension between knowledge and community head on. Our source material makes it clear that Paul doesn't mince words. He comes right out and says there's only one God, period. And all those other gods and idols the Corinthians were surrounded by, they're nothing. They hold no real power. That's the knowledge rooted in that Jewish Christian tradition that he's starting with.
Makes sense. But I'm guessing it wasn't that simple for everyone.
Oh, you got it. That's where it gets interesting. Paul recognizes that not everyone in the Corinthian church was on the same page, so to speak. Some folks, their conscience, he says, was still weak. And what that means is they still felt this strong sense of guilt, this association with idol worship, if they ate food that had been offered in those pagan temples.
Interesting. So it's not just about having the right information. It's about how that information is, processed, internalized.
Yeah, exactly. And it's important to note, as our source points out, that this weakness isn't meant to be a criticism of their character or anything. It's more like their worldview was still undergoing a major renovation. They hadn't fully integrated this huge shift to monotheism. So their conscience, that inner voice, that check against their values, was still going off at the very thought of eating this food.
Okay, so what does Paul say about how to handle that kind of situation within a community where people are coming from these different places?
Well, he really emphasizes this idea of love. Not just love as a feeling, but love as an action, as putting the well-being of your community first. And he lays down this principle of not causing your brother or sister to stumble or fall into sin because of something you do, even if you yourself are convinced it's perfectly fine.
Fall into sin. I'm curious about how that's being used here.
Yeah, great question. It's not about some external judgment, like someone else condemning them. Our source explains it more as the person themselves acting against their own deeply held convictions. They're violating their own developing worldview. And in the process, they're actually harming their own conscience, kind of like setting a bad precedent for themselves.
That's pretty insightful. So it's not just about avoiding something that might look bad to others, but about protecting the integrity of the individual's own internal compass.
Exactly. And you really see how serious Paul is about this and how he applies it to himself. He actually says, if what I eat causes my brother or sister to fall into sin, I will never eat meat again. Like, wow, that's a pretty radical commitment right there. It really shows how much he prioritized the spiritual well-being of the community, even if it meant setting aside his own personal freedom.
Powerful stuff. And I can see how this is starting to connect to, us today. We're not dealing with food sacrificed to idols, but we face similar situations all the time.
Oh, for sure. I mean, think about any group you're a part of, your family, your friends, your workplace, even online communities. You're always going to have people at different stages of understanding, different beliefs, different levels of, I don't know, how should I put it, worldview maturity.
Absolutely. And this is where that need for education, for thoughtful dialogue really comes into play, right? It's about creating a space where people can grow in their understanding, where their consciences can be informed by a well-thought-out worldview.
Yeah. But there's a really interesting point our source brings up about this idea of accommodation.
Mm-hmm.
You know, being patient and understanding with those who maybe haven't fully grasped things yet is crucial. But how long does that accommodation need to last?
Yeah, that's a good point. It's kind of like, at what point does it stop being about a weak conscience and become more about a resistance to the truth, you know?
Right. And maybe that calls for a different approach within the community. It's something to think about for sure.
Definitely. But it seems like in this particular situation with the Corinthians, Paul's main focus is on education and, as you said before, love. He affirms that knowledge that idols are ultimately meaningless, but he's constantly stressing that love and patiently guiding the community are just as important, maybe even more so, in how you act.
Okay, so let's move on to chapter 9, where Paul shifts gears a little and starts talking about rights. As an apostle, he had certain rights, things he was entitled to, like receiving financial support from the churches he served. Our source really emphasizes this point. It was a legitimate privilege, a right that was recognized.
Okay, but I'm sensing a but coming here.
Oh, there's a big but here. Paul chose not to exercise this right. He actually supported himself, probably through his work as a tent maker. And our source even draws this connection to the social dynamics in Corinth, where the elite, the upper crust, really emphasized their rights. Sometimes even at the expense of, well, Christian values.
Wow, that's quite a contrast, isn't it? You have Paul, who could have easily asserted his rights, demanded support, but he chooses to step aside, to work with his own hands.
It really makes you think, doesn't it? And the reason behind it, according to our source, wasn't just about obligation or duty. Paul was aiming for something more. He wanted to go above and beyond to enter into this realm of reward. It's not that he's saying everyone has to do this, but it's this interesting idea, especially for those in positions of leadership.
I like that. It's not about imposing a rule, but about setting a higher standard, a different way of approaching leadership.
And you see this attitude so clearly in what he says, though I am free, I have made myself a slave to all. It's almost like he's redefining what true freedom means.
Yeah, it's not just about what you're entitled to, but about what you choose to do with that freedom.
And then he uses this really vivid analogy of an athletic competition. He says, all the runners run, but only one receives the prize. And he talks about how rigorous the training is. Our source connects this to the dedication that's needed in ministry and Christian community as a whole. Paul didn't want to be disqualified from the ultimate prize by taking shortcuts or putting his own comfort first.
There's a real sense of purpose and discipline there, and it seems like this sets the stage for what he's going to say next.
Right. So we move into chapter 10, and now Paul brings in this historical narrative, this story of Israel in the wilderness. He's using it as a cautionary tale for the Corinthians. He reminds them of all the amazing things God did for them. The protective cloud, the Red Sea crossing, even providing them with what he calls spiritual food and drink, which he links to Christ. Talk about spiritual privilege, right?
Huge privileges, but it sounds like things didn't exactly go smoothly for them.
Oh, not exactly. Our source really emphasizes this point.
Hmm.
Even with all those blessings, most of them still didn't please God. And their failures, things like giving in to their desires, idolatry, sexual immorality, testing God, constantly complaining, all of these become examples for the Corinthians, not in a this is going to happen to you way, but more like, look what happens when people go down this path.
Okay, so it's more about recognizing patterns of behavior and the consequences that can follow. Like, history might not repeat exactly, but there are these underlying principles at work.
Yeah, exactly. It's like learning from the mistakes of the past, even if your situation isn't identical.
Makes sense. So what's the main takeaway for the Corinthians? For us, really?
Well, the big point is this. Just because you have these spiritual privileges, these blessings, doesn't mean you could just disregard moral principles. In fact, privilege comes with responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
And Paul warns them directly. He says, so if you think you stand firm, be careful that you don't fall. It's a warning against complacency, against thinking you're somehow immune to messing things up.
A good reminder for all of us, I think.
Definitely. But it's not all doom and gloom. Paul also offers some encouragement. He says, no temptation has overtaken you except what is common to mankind. And God is faithful. He'll not let you be tempted beyond what you can bear. Our source points out that this doesn't necessarily mean you'll always escape temptation, but that God will provide a way for you to endure it. And that comes through having the right perspective, making choices that are aligned with your values.
It's about standing firm in your convictions, even when it's tough.
Exactly. And all of this leads up to that clear command, flee from idolatry. Paul brings it all back to that central issue. And our source emphasizes that there's no ambiguity here in chapter 10. It's a very direct, forceful prohibition against any involvement in idolatry.
All right, so he's laid down the law on that one. No messing around with idols.
Right. And he continues on this theme in verses 14 through 22, getting even more specific about avoiding any participation in these idolatrous practices. He uses the example of the Israelites eating the sacrificial offerings, how that was a form of taking part in the altar itself.
Okay, so he's drawing a clear line. And I'm guessing he's going to explain exactly where that line is.
He does. He states very clearly that those pagan sacrifices are actually offered to demons. This means that any association with those feasts, anything that honors idols, and remember, in that context, that could even include things like being forced to worship the Roman emperor as a god, all of that was completely unacceptable for believers.
Wow. No gray areas there.
Nope. He's drawing a hard boundary.
Well,
and he says it straight up. You cannot drink the cup of the Lord and the cup of demons. You cannot have a part in both the Lord's table and the table of demons. Our source really emphasizes this incompatibility. You can't try to straddle both worlds.
So it's about making a clear choice, a commitment.
Absolutely. And then, as we move into chapter 10, verses 23 through 11.1, Paul starts talking about a believer's freedom and the importance of considering how your actions affect others. He reiterates this idea, I have the right to do anything, but then immediately adds, but not everything is beneficial or constructive.
Okay, so freedom comes with responsibility. I'm hearing that theme again.
You got it. And then he lays down what I think is a foundational principle, this guiding rule. No one should seek their own good, but the good of others. Our source points out that this goes way beyond just the food issue. It's about how you live your life, how you interact with the world. Your rights aren't the only thing that matters. The well-being of those around you, the integrity of truth, those are equally important.
So it's about balancing your freedom with the needs of others, with what's truly right.
Right. And then Paul gets really practical. He says, if you're a believer, you can eat meat that's being sold in the market. You don't have to worry about whether it was offered to idols or not, because, as he says, an idol is nothing. It can't actually contaminate the food.
Makes sense. So no need to become a food detective, tracing back the origins of every piece of meat.
Exactly. And then he addresses another common situation. Being invited to a meal at the home of someone who's not a believer. He says, go ahead and eat what they serve you. No need to make a big deal out of it. Our source clarifies that this isn't about being willfully ignorant. It's about recognizing that idols don't have this inherent power to taint the food itself.
So it's about grace, about focusing on the relationship, not on some technicality.
Yeah. But then he gives this crucial exception. If your host specifically says, hey, this food was offered as a sacrifice, then don't eat it. And the reason isn't primarily about your own conscience. It's about the conscience of your host or anyone else there who might misinterpret your actions as honoring the idol.
So it's about being sensitive to how your actions might be perceived, even if you know the truth in your heart.
Exactly. It's about avoiding confusion, not creating stumbling blocks for others, even if they're not believers. As our source puts it, the overarching principle is this. So whether you eat or drink or whatever you do, do it all for the glory of God. Do not cause anyone to stumble, whether Jews, Greeks, or the Church of God.
And he follows his own advice, right? Doesn't he say something about imitating him as he imitates Christ?
Yeah, he does. He holds himself up as an example, saying, just as I try to please everyone in every way, not seeking my own good but that of many, so that they may be saved, follow my example as I follow the example of Christ.
Powerful stuff. It's about putting those principles into practice, not just talking about them.
For sure. And our source makes a good point here about the challenge of applying these principles in different cultural contexts.
Yeah.
You know, in the first century, believers were often kind of embedded in these very pagan societies like Corinth. And even today, we have to figure out how to navigate all these different cultural pressures and expectations.
It's a constant process of discernment, figuring out how to live out your faith in the world you're in.
Absolutely. And speaking of discernment, this whole discussion keeps coming back to the idea of conscience. So it's really helpful that our source has this whole section devoted to unpacking what the Bible means by conscience.
Okay, I'm all ears. Break it down for me.
Well, it starts by saying that your conscience isn't like this magical guide that just comes up with opinions or values out of nowhere. It's more like an internal monitor, something that checks your actions against the values and worldview you already have.
So it's not dictating what to believe, but it's checking whether you're living in accordance with what you already hold to be true.
Yeah. You know, our source uses this analogy of a computer system. Your worldview, your core beliefs, those are like the operating system, the central database.
Mm-hmm.
And your conscience is like this self-awareness mechanism, checking whether your actions are compatible with that database.
I like that analogy. It makes it more concrete.
And this is a really important point.
Mm.
Just because your conscience is clear in a situation doesn't mean that what you're doing is objectively right. If your worldview is flawed, if it's incomplete, then your conscience is just going to reinforce those potentially wrong values.
Yeah. The problem isn't necessarily the conscience itself. It's the foundation it's built on.
Right. And it's interesting to note that there isn't really a direct equivalent for conscience in the Hebrew of the Old Testament. The concept really becomes prominent in the New Testament, especially in Paul's writings. Our source suggests that this whole issue with the food offered to idols might have actually spurred this deeper reflection on conscience within the early church.
Hmm, that's fascinating. So they were really wrestling with these ideas, trying to figure out how it all fit together.
Absolutely. And to summarize what our source says about conscience, it's this inner awareness, this witness to the values and norms that you've recognized and adopted in your life. It doesn't create those values itself. It's more like a God-given capacity for self-critique, a part of being self-aware.
Okay, so it's not some external voice, but it's also not just making stuff up. It's this internal feedback system that's working with what's already there.
Exactly. And this is crucial. Our source really stresses that your conscience is not the voice of God or the devil talking to you. It's your own thoughts and feelings filtered through your understanding of right and wrong. When you're making decisions, your worldview and values are driving the action, and your conscience is there to check whether that action lines up with what you believe.
Got it. It's like a final check, making sure everything is consistent.
Right. And our source even looks at Paul's statement in 1 Corinthians 4.4, where he says, I am not aware of anything against myself, but that does not make me innocent. It is the Lord who judges me. The point being, even though Paul's conscience was clear, that wasn't the final word. It's this reminder that our own self-assessment isn't the ultimate measure of whether we're right or wrong.
So humility is key here. We can't just rely on our own judgment. There's a higher authority at work.
Exactly. So as we wrap up this deep dive, I think the main takeaways from Paul's guidance to the Corinthians are pretty clear. He really models for us how to hold on to truth while also being loving and considerate towards those who are maybe in a different place than us.
Yeah, it's a delicate balance, isn't it? And it highlights the ongoing importance of really thinking critically about our worldview, about how we form our values and beliefs, and understanding how conscience works, how it's this monitor of those values, is essential for making wise decisions, for navigating the complexities of life.
Absolutely. And what strikes me is how relevant all of this is for us today. We might not be dealing with food offered to idols, but we face similar challenges all the time. We're constantly encountering different viewpoints, cultural pressures, ethical dilemmas, and Paul's emphasis on putting others first, on acting in ways that don't cause them to stumble. That's incredibly valuable for us.
Yeah, it's timeless wisdom. It's about living out our convictions in a way that's both truthful and compassionate.
Exactly. And I think a great question for all of us to consider as we leave this conversation is this. How well-defined are our own worldview and values? Are they rooted in something solid, something reliable? And how effectively does our conscience serve as a check against those values, especially when we face those tough issues, the ones that can be divisive?
Yeah, that's a great question to wrestle with. It's about constantly examining ourselves, making sure we're not just drifting along, but that we're intentionally building our lives on a solid foundation.
Couldn't have said it better myself. Thanks for joining me on this deep dive. And for all of you listening, keep thinking, keep questioning, and keep seeking truth.
And keep diving deep. We'll see you next time.